and opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium. Brother Najee, you can start.
Okay.
I can't hear you, Brother Najee.
Good evening. Good evening. This is Onaje Maweed. Good evening. This is Onaje Maweed. Good evening. This is Onaje Maweed. Coming to you on the program Race Treaty. Some of you may have been listening for a while, and some of you may, in fact, may be new listeners. Race Treaty comes to you every Friday evening between 9 and 10, or sometimes an extended program, which we hope to do tonight. The purpose of our program is to lean heavily on ICER, the International Convention to Eliminate Racial Discrimination, and to bring in also other international covenants, conventions, and norms. And we want to use this radio platform that has been given to us by Black Talk Radio Network as an organizing vehicle. So it's not just a question of talking heads. We attempt to, in fact, feature organizers on the ground that are bringing international human rights work into their local realities to show that, we are a people, we are a oppressed nation, and we are still fighting for our liberation. And to do that means we need to be organized. As a member of the East Organization in Brooklyn, New York, we have to educate, agitate, and organize, and that's still appropriate today, certainly. Tonight's program, Reflections from the Association for the Study of African Life and History, the 102nd, and I did say that, the 102nd annual conference, annual meeting and conference by the Association for the Study of African American Life and Study, ASLA. As some of the listeners may know, it was founded by the esteemed Carter G. Woodson. And if you haven't read the book, Miseducation of the Negro, you want to order it tonight, tomorrow, as soon as you can, and read it. Take out the word Negro, put in the word African American, and everything that was written is just as true today as it was in 1933. One of his most often quotes is that if you control a man's thinking, you don't have to worry about his actions. He will make a back door, if there isn't one, out of his own necessity. So we're talking about the psychological makeup of a human being and how they, in fact, live their lives. And we have guests on tonight's show who have been, they've dedicated these lives to the liberation of our people and the improvement of our conditions. Invited to tonight's program are Yes, Elder Muhammad Ahmed, PhD, African American Studies and Political Science Professor in Philadelphia. Elder Professor Emeritus Charles Simmons and his wife, Reverend Sandra Simmons, who are co-directors of Hush House Black Community Museum and Leadership Training Institute for Human Rights and Community Sustainability in Detroit, as well as Keon Pittaway, Professor of Communications, PhD as well, Eastern Michigan University, and also Fatima Hafiz, PhD, out of Philadelphia. Her organization is Transformative Education Associates. So I would like to bring our guests on, have them introduce themselves in the order in which I announced them, and they can say a little bit about themselves and why are they here at this conference. What do they intend to accomplish? I'll just start with those two questions, and we'll do a round with that. Introduce themselves. Why are they here at this conference in Cincinnati, Ohio? And what do they intend the conference? Elder Muhammad Ahmed, are you on the line? If you're on the line, you might have to push ** on your phone to be heard. Okay, it seems we may be having a little technical difficulty at this moment. I'll go on.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I do. Elder Muhammad Ahmed?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Greetings. Assalamu alaikum, beloved.
Walaikum salam.
Thank you so much.
Sure. Yeah, well, I'm of the generation just to serve and to help and depart of the lessons that we learned often the hard way. So in my thesis, which is published on the Revolutionary Action Movement, we talk about the COINTELPRO program, which we were targeted, one of the first targets in the 1960s, and also in the workshop of how many of us survived by learning from the elders in the community who had been repressed in the 20 years before us. We took a low profile and a multi-level approach in organization in attempting in organizing institutions, advancing on issues, in changing laws. Often we didn't take the credit organizationally, but I think we left, if we had to leave our communities, often some of us were incarcerated. And so but when we came back, I think we had helped nurture the indigenous leadership that's in every community to advance. So we helped advance the struggle, and we tried to take the less casualties and that you can possibly take. And so we try to depart that on as a continuous strategy where we learn from our elders that you want to leave a community in a better shape than it was before you initiated any kind of action, helped initiate any kind of action within the community. And so one reason why we were invited was to depart it. And our organization was much different in the sense that we had collective leadership, and we still have collective leadership. We learn from one another, and we learn from the people, and also try to depart our wisdom back. Many of us have traveled internationally and learned from other people's struggle. You can't adopt everything, but you can synthesize what Malcolm said. When you study other, go and study other people who have been successful against the same power structure that you're against, you can take some of those tactics and apply them to your own. And so this is what the Revolutionary Action Movement attempted to do. And when we say low profile, this doesn't mean we were hiding from anybody. We were in plain sight, you know. But we were not braggadocious. We learned from other people as far as strategy is concerned. You may not want to take on the state head on because you may not be around tomorrow. And we stopped using our name at the point that our name was being blamed or being used as paranoia repression to eliminate new leadership. And so we decided just to dissolve into the whirlwind. And that, if you study other people's movement, other people have done the same thing, you know. But the object is to, you know, develop the philosophy or strategy in the African American community. One, we're in war. You're born in war. All right. You're a captive of war. But that consciousness is not there. So when you get that consciousness, then you can develop the strategy to survive. And that wisdom is in the African-American community. So we have to synthesize that wisdom from generation to generation until it becomes crystallized. And the system as what we said in the 1960s. The longer that capitalism exists, the worse African Americans' condition will become. And I think we can see that even after a black president, the conditions are worse now. Right? And with this administration, the empire is in crisis. So what is our role but to bring or crystallize this understanding first to African American youth, because that's the generation that the system is focusing on, to, hey, you got to get it together. You got to, you know, put whatever your priorities are. you have to become focused because you're under fascism now, outright fascism. And that we can help you only to a certain extent, but you have to develop, because this is the period, right? And so what we try to show is that the world's under fascism, led by number one in Washington, to create permanent war, instability of everyone else that is not in agreement with them, to create permanent unequal development so that they will survive, whatever their prodigy is, that they will survive and still be on top. And this is the question in the 21st century, as Du Bois had laid out the question of the color line in the 20th century. So I don't know if that hits any kind of note or not, but that's why I'm here.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And what do you intend to accomplish by being here at this conference?
Is to just gel minds. You know, I'm a student of Malcolm X, or El Hajj Malik El-Shabazz, and one of his things, his prominent ideas was, I just want you to think for yourself. You know, think. Don't, you know, take all this, you know, they're bombarding us 24/7. Think. So if you think for yourself, you can be an instrument for our people's liberation.
Thinking for yourself, that is so powerful. To the listening audience, let me bring your attention to the now available publication, RAM, Revolutionary Action Movement, A Case Study of an Urban Revolutionary Movement in Western Capitalist Society, by the guest who just spoke, who was also formerly known as Maxwell or Max Stanford. Some of you may remember that name, because anything that had to do with the liberation of our people over the last 30 to 40 years, somewhere that name would be there. In the inside cover, it says, "Blessed are those who dare to struggle." And of course, I'm thinking that quote comes from The Last Poets. I think it's from that. That's what it reminds me of. Elder Ahmed says, "This special thanks goes to all the mentors past and those who are still living, and to all the thousands of freedom fighters past, present, and future who were, are, and will be members of the Revolutionary Action Movement and the various organization formations which have and are contributing to an independent black liberation movement, and to all our allies who have and still are fighting along with us in solidarity. In solidarity with the working class and oppressed peoples of the world who have continuously fought oppression for over 50,000 years, we say thank you. Blessed are those who dare to struggle. To the African-American people and all the freedom-loving peoples of the world, our struggle, one struggle, many fronts. Dare to struggle, dare to win. A people united will never be defeated. We will win. Blessed are those who dare to struggle. Blessed are those who win." So we want people to purchase this very important historical book that speaks about his involvement and our people's involvement for our liberation. And I just got it today, so I can't tell you the full content of it in his pages, but I know that I'll have to become a student of it, learn from it, and pass that on. And we'll have remarks by Elder Muhammad Ahmed shortly after. Now, I'd like to also invite to speak to answer those same two questions, Elder Professor Menteris Charles Simmons, and thereafter, hopefully, his wife, Reverend Sandra Simmons, who are co-directors of Hush House, Black Community Museum and Leadership Training Institute for Human Rights and Community Sustainability in Detroit, Michigan. Elder Simmons, are you available and are you on the line? If you are, you might have to press the star button twice in order to be heard.
You turned it off.
I said do it twice.
Okay, I can hear you now.
Okay.
I can hear you
okay,
now.
Okay, we're here. We're here.
Oh, and wonderful. Wonderful. So we will... Yes,
good
evening,
go ahead. Family.
This is Bobby yes. Charles Simmons and my wife. I'm going to let my wife proceed first, Reverend Sandra Simmons.
Thank you,
wonderful.
Family. It's so good to be with you this this evening. And I'm thankful that you do have this platform. We've had occasion to talk about the power of the Black media, so we're very glad and thankful that that you and your wife are making this possible.
We are happy
to
do so.
Thank you. So as to the questions that you asked, I'm old, so you're going to have to remind me. I have one of them I have here is that what do we hope to accomplish, which is the second question. And the first question is, was that why we're here?
Yes, yes. Why are you here at this 102nd, which is certainly very impressive, the 102nd annual meeting and conference for this organization?
Well, we're very, very thankful that Dr. John Bracey, he has been instrumental in our being here, and we're very thankful for his inviting us and helping to make that possible for us to bring the Hush House or some semblance of the Hush House here, and to be among our peers, because we're also educators and but more importantly our brothers and sisters in the community of education and fighting for the privilege of standing before our communities and our youth and to share what we know and what we've been through and these walks that we've had in this life, and just so grateful that our Creator has allowed us to make it through everything that we've been through. Individually and collectively, and to walk around this place is to hear these stories. I mean, in every corner there's some stories being told, and in the faces of the people walking these halls, and as you just heard my brother speak, the privilege and the honor of this work is a deep sacrifice, but it's a deep privilege and honor to be able to serve our people in that capacity. We're here because we wanted to share and learn, because it's always, we know about teaching, it's always a two-way street. The best teachers are the best students, I feel, because there's a hunger in you to know. And when we're in service to our people, the hunger is to know as much as about our people as we can. I know for us at Hush House, we are just so grateful for Black leadership And when we look at people, we see leaders, because we know that we have a purpose as a people. We have a purpose in this earth, or elsewise, how could we ever survive the atrocities and the things that we have been through? How can we bear the awful, horrible pains that we've seen, and torture of our children and people, and yet we keep getting up? We refuse to die, and we're writing it down, and we're testifying about it, and we're bearing witness to it. And this miracle in us of being able to do that, everybody cannot do that, but we're so busy living again. And but I think that to go to that second question about what do I hope to accomplish is, in terms of the work that we do with our Leadership and Training Institute and through the Simmons Center, which are our local global, we believe very deeply in the reality that we are global citizens. It's just about the information that's been repressed from us and learning who we are, but learning and remembering again the things that we have forgotten. And what being here has allowed me to get a refreshing on that, just being around so many wonderful and caring people, brilliant people who are so humble and so kind. Remembering, for instance, things like the power of women's influence and helping our sisters to, and learning ways sisters are doing it, and helping us to remember the power of our influence. And, you know, thinking about during the captivity how mothers had the power in their tongues to resurrect our people coming across the threshold, no matter what it looked like or how it be. You know, you would walk across that threshold and you would be whole. You would be somehow, you would know you were loved and that you meant something, that you were a human being. And then crossing that threshold of pain and going on the other side out into the public and becoming this monster, because monsters have seen fit to make you a tool in their production of greed and avarice. So women remembering the power that we have and teaching again how to implement and use that power to help heal each other and our families, our men, but most importantly ourselves, because, my God, we've been through so much and we're going through so much because they are taking, and as we all know, attacking our homes and robbing us of our men yet again, and younger and younger. So there's so much work to be done. And so Asala, in its 102 years, it bears a witness of all of that. And so for that, I'm just so thankful to be here. So I'll give it to my husband now.
I want to let folks who are just tuning in, this is Onaji Mawid, host of Race Treaty, that comes to you every Friday evening between 9 and 10 or sometimes 11. And we're speaking to some of the participants at the 102nd Annual Meeting and Conference for the Association for the Study of African-American Life and History, the theme being the crisis in Black education. And it seems so fitting that we would certainly bring into this conversation Elhaj El-Malik Shabazz, properly known as Malcolm X, when most people hear and know of the quote, him saying, education is our passport to the future, for tomorrow belongs to the people who prepare for it today. We're very familiar with that segment, that sentence segment. However, we don't usually hear the whole sentence. Just before that, he says, education is an important element in the struggle for human rights. It is the means to help our children and thereby increase self-respect. Then he goes on to say, education is our passport to the future, for tomorrow belongs to the people who prepare for it today. You cannot enjoy the full benefit of his knowledge if you don't have both part one and part two of those sentences. And if we leave out
the necessity for human rights education. How then can we engage ourselves in a human rights struggle? You have to be educated about something before you can do something, or at least have the concepts and the theories to push you forward. The practice of theory and practice together. So this conference is talking about the crisis in Black education, and right in that quote right there, it brings it to life. And the Hush House, as I've been informed, the Hush House Black History Community Museum originated at Howard University in 1987 as a traveling exhibit by the alumni in the Smithsonian Institute. In 2000, it developed into a community museum located in Midtown Detroit. Today, the Hush House consists of three main components. One, the Hush House Black History Museum, which includes many artifacts and exhibits that celebrate and tell stories that emphasize the power of the Black experience. Two, the Hush House Leadership and Training Institute, which offers leadership development and education under the guidance of Charles and Sandra Simmons, who both have over 40 years' experience as journalists, educators, lecturers, and grassroots activists and organizers. And three, the Simmons Center for Peace and Social Justice Studies, whose mission is to bring together young leaders for the collaboration community-based projects. And then four, Hush Your Mouth Media Project, which provides a range of multimedia training experiences. I can't wait to get to Detroit, not only to visit my grandson, Aaron, who lives in Detroit, but also to visit this center, the museum, have a tour, and see all the things that they're doing in action. As a community-based facility with broad range of interests and concerns, there will be opportunities for both study and participatory learning in the following areas: social sciences, which includes urban studies, social movements, race relations, labor relations, and community engagements, as well as public history, museum and archival studies, as well as restorative justice, peace zones, and prison abolition. For service learning, building sustainable communities in post-industrial cities, including green infrastructure, architecture and planning, urban gardening, environmental justice, alternative power sources, water rights, public health, education, legal studies, faith. I mean, I think the whole, you know, all our people need to go to Detroit to see what these brothers and sisters are doing. So, Brother Simmons, please tell us, why are you at this conference and what you intend to achieve by your presence there?
Well, thanks again, my brother. Well, we came to, as my wife said, we came to learn and share, to find out what's happening around the country, because there's so many people, positive people, doing things that are uplifting our people. And we don't hear about that in the mainstream media, and I mean, there are some on social media and the independent media, but it's so good to be able to meet people face to face in a conference site and share the information directly. And it's very inspiring to find out that other people are doing such positive work. And it's also inspiring to see young people come, and these are people who are going to take over our work and take the struggle further to deal with the new issues that we have. So it's been just a wonderful experience being here and absorbing this information and sharing what we're doing. And also we're inviting young people from various universities to come and do internships at our space and share in all the different fields of knowledge that contribute to nation building, because we are in the process of building a community of compassion where we're using all of those different types of skills, housing, urban development. We're dealing with water issues, and people have read about what's happening in Flint and in Detroit with the water shutoffs, and in Flint with the poisoning of the water. So we have to have people in our own community who can, you know, be engineers and architects and the medical people who can handle all those types of problems, and environmentalists. So that's what we, now there are people who are doing those sorts of things in the their universities are training young people to do this, but often they're not focusing on this immediate need that we have now. Often they're focusing on a career to get a job, and that's good, but we need to go beyond getting a job. We need to be thinking of how we could take care of ourselves and prosper independently and build our own institutions, as Dr. Carter G. Woodson has taught, you know, 100 years ago. So that's the spirit in which we come here, and we're so happy to be able to do that and honored to be participating in the conference under Dr. Woodford's name.
Thank you so very much. You mentioned young people, and that's what we're going to do right now. We're going to shift from this esteemed eldership as represented in the three voices you heard previously, and we're going to go to a young'un. I'm hoping he's on the line. I'm sure he is. Brother Keon Pittaway, if I'm saying it correctly, professor of communication at Eastern Michigan University in Michigan. Brother Keon, are you on the line?
I am here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Yes, I can. So, you've heard a few times in the previous guests speak about youth, the involvement, the need for them to focus on the reality of our people currently right now, just their careers, instead of just their careers. And you being the youth of this conversation, I want to welcome you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me to be part of this wonderful conversation. First, I want to say peace, blessings, and bright moments to everyone. I think we're at a certain stage, not simply because of what's happening, of course, in our political sphere in the United States, right? We're talking about something that's transnational, and it has more to do with our political sphere and much to do most about humanity and the spirit, right? This is what is at stake at the moment. So I think now is an apt time to have this conversation. To address the two questions, why am I here and what do I hope to accomplish? Quite simply, I have the same goals as the three elders have already expressed. Gaining wisdom and regeneration was my major reason for coming to the conference and being part of the conversation, to gain wisdom from those who have been where here is now, right, and can help us sort of chart a future for where can here be later. And then on the side of regeneration, I think it's important that we remember to take care of ourselves. Right, and to take care of our own health, and I think at moments when we give so much of ourselves to liberation, we also have to remember that we need those moments of regeneration. Right, we need to be among people who are also committed and serious about liberation, and serious about humanity, and serious about love. And I think that regeneration period for me has rang true since being here at the conference. So that's sort of the main reason why I wanted to come. In that regard, there has been one question that sort of has three parts that has been addressed thus far at the conference through three themes that sort of address still those two questions: why am I here? What do I hope to accomplish? One of those questions is, where is here when we talk about the crisis in Black education, right? This has to do much with a continuity question. Where is here now? Where has here been before, and where can here be in another time and space? And then there's this idea of a sort of symbiotic knot that when we're talking about liberation and we're also talking about colonization in regards to crisis in the black education, I don't think it's an either or. I think it's a symbiotic knot where we're continually trying to tease out these tenses and these tensions and trying to create a different kind of elastic moment where we can sort of thrive. So in that regard, I think, you know, in thinking about this idea of liberation and colonization, what do I hope to accomplish here? I hope to sort of look at these two lenses and figure out how do we sort of tease them apart a bit. On the other hand, there's this question, this quantification of the black body. And when we talk about here and this continuity question, this sort of quantification of the black body is coming through strong regarding digital media, building communities, in the ways in which the black body is now being redefined by our technologies of the day, right? And so one of the reasons why I'm here and what I hope to accomplish is really understanding what's at stake when we're talking about humanity and the quantification of the body and black peoples in the digisphere, right? This is a different kind of sort that we're dealing with, but it's very familiar. And I think what's important to sort of ground that is that still this quantification in the media that we're using is still built upon a capitalistic society. So when we talk about liberation and we talk about still colonization, I think we have to talk about those terms even on the field of the digisphere. So those sort of three sort of themes are helping me kind of think about, you know, further, why am I here and what do I hope to accomplish? I'm kind of in the midst of the cusp of the millennial generation, but to this continuity question, I'm, you know, I come from the South. I've farmed. I have seen what poor looks like. We had outhouses. We didn't have running water. We used a pump on the back porch. I was out in the, you know, out in the fields, in tobacco, driving tractors, and seeing through the lens of my ancestors just a snippet of what they had to deal with regarding education. So I'll stop there, but those are the many reasons why I'm here and what I hope to accomplish.
Youngin, thank you so much. And it's funny when you were saying outhouses and fields, you know, I was you took me back. I have a very, very unique or fairly unique history in that I was raised in a small town from zero to about seven, a small town called Closter, New Jersey, which is in Bergen County. And there, my people were, we settled the land, you know, we squatted, and we were down this dirt road were all family members, uncles, aunts, cousins. It's nothing but family. It was like a village. And we didn't have plumbing. We had well water. You know, we had to have the jar of water by the pump. It's called priming the pump. You have to have the water in order to get the pump to work before you can get the water out the ground. We had outhouses that we had to use, and we had subsistence farming in terms of, you know, little farm. We had a horse, we had a cow, you know. So all you had to do is change my dialect and I would have been down south right there with you. And all you had to do is change our clothing and then we'd have been in Africa someplace. So when you said those things, you probably wouldn't think that someone in the North could share those experiences. But indeed I did, in a smaller scale, because we was down this dirt road. But there are many enclaves. If I ever get a chance to do some study and research, I know the town in Ridgewood had a similar setup where blacks were like pushed, you know, a century away back from what other people were living in that area. But I'm sure there are many those types of enclaves throughout New Jersey and probably throughout the country where we were just living in a different century and time. I would love to see if anyone's done any research like that. So I do understand what you mean when you say that you didn't have electricity, you didn't have running water. I was in the same boat, and many of the elders on the call might have experienced that somewhat in their life, if not in the North, maybe when they having relatives in the South would have experienced that. So we're really talking about development. It says in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Everyone is entitled to participate in, contribute to, and enjoy economic, social, cultural, and political development, in which all human rights and fundamental freedoms can be fully realized. So we know that our struggle for liberation is a struggle for development, mentally, physically, spiritually, economically, socially, and our liberation struggle is will not stop until we have, in fact, attained all of our human rights. And it's good to see that we have in you a younger generation that is continuing this, because we know that this is a long, it's a protracted struggle. It's not one that's going to be one in a century, in a decade. And it seems like we're on a few at least 5 centuries at this point. So we still have at least probably one more to go. I'd like now to ask the elders, what questions do you have for this young man, this man who has obtained his doctorate, his PhD? You heard a little bit of his concentration. He presented here at the conference, in fact, where he was on the panel with my illustrious, beautiful wife, who has worked so hard and will not be on the show tonight because she is sleeping, and I don't dare to wake her up, because she's worked hard in preparation for this conference. And I think, as the brothers, young brother said, we need we need to have wellness and take care of ourselves, restitution. So I'm going to let her get that rest, also dealing with that big R. But I met him on the panel, and I was quite impressed with him, and so glad that we were able to exchange information. So I'm going to ask the elders, what questions do you have of this young man, or maybe what instructions would you like to pass on this young man? And then he will have a chance, to ask each one of you, individually or collectively, some questions that he has in his mind about your generations and the kind of battles you fought and the strategies you used to win, so that could help him in the work that he's doing. So so now we're going to ask the elders to ask Brother Keon about any of his comments or anything in general.
I would like to hear a summary of what he presented at that panel, because we didn't have access to that. If you could just give us an overview. Yes.
Okay. Can you still hear me? Okay. Can you still hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So my presentation was the brief synopsis is how to use and really recognize the expansiveness of thinking about King in a global aspect, right, in a transnational aspect, and particularly when we're looking at King's speeches and his works, especially when we teach it in the classroom, may that be in history, or may that be in communication, and may that be in political science. Though I don't have all the data on this, this is coming from loose data that I do have. The ways in which King is presented both in the popular sphere sometimes is the same way in which he gets figured, and the civil rights at that sometimes maybe the same way it's figured in the classroom, especially introductory classes. And so what I presented on is using a framework of thinking about the transnationality and the space and place of race, is how to use King's works, particularly him and some of his well-known or some of his not his his understudy speeches, as a way to think about the transnational space of human rights and the transnational space of interculturality and race, and how do we use those as sort of a jumping-off point to think about how do we build global citizenship for students. And so one way that I present it is to how to look at digital humanities and digital technology as both an opening and a closing. The first sort of opening, there's been a range of projects on King that have put forth a sort of public humanities of his speeches, have given some educational and instructional tools, And some have even used visual archives and other kinds of media to understand the sort of length and the breadth of the civil rights movement through the work that King was doing. So in one of the projects that I'm a co-investigator on, which is a virtual MLK project, we use King's Fill Up the Jail speech that he gave in Durham, North Carolina, which was one of the key times that he noted that he would put support behind direct nonviolent action by filling up the jails of the South. And so given that speech, it was so important, and we see it come through strong in a letter from Birmingham. There is no recording of the speech. The church was torn down, and there is little media archives of the speech. So we did a recreation. We did utilized a voice actor from Michigan. We did some professional recordings. We also did a range of public exhibitions, including visual and audio archives. Right now, we're doing a range of virtual reality and 3D demos of the interior of the sanctuary while King is actually giving the speech. So you can kind of experience from the congregation on the floor, from the podium, and also up in the balcony. But at the same time, even though that opens up some space for understanding and having some transformational experiences of race, it closes opportunities by not talking about the transnationality of space and race, right? In that same speech that King gave about filling up the jails, this was 3 years after Ghana's independence. And we know that King went to Ghana, right, during independence, and he gave a speech, a sermon, not too long after returning from Ghana. But in this 1960 speech, he also mentions, just as well as he does as many of his other key Fill Up the Jail speeches, he mentions the liberation and independence movements in Africa and Asia, and we tend to slip right over that, right? We move right over that key part of what King was trying to get at and how he was being influenced and what was at stake, and that was global human rights, not necessarily simply civil rights in the United States. So what I presented on is giving a framework for how to understand both how do we really think about and teach King's speeches in that way, but also when we're delivering digital projects on civil rights, how can we sort of critique these projects that do a wonderful job at the same time, but think about what they close down? What are the opportunities that are still remain froze? So that was sort of the gist of what I presented on.
Okay. Well, that's quite a bit. One of the speeches that I think is very important, well, very important to me, was his speech about the war in Vietnam, why he was opposed to the war in Vietnam, and how that had a negative effect on poverty in the United States, because there had been an agreement in Congress with the president before, with President Kennedy and Johnson, that they were going to actually eliminate poverty, if you can believe that. And there was there used to be a regular Humphrey Hawkins bill to eliminate poverty throughout the late 50s, early 60s. But after the Vietnam War started, all the money that was supposed to be going for poverty elimination was shifted to bombs and bullets and tanks and all that to destroy this Asian country. And so now, and that created a major, that contributed to a major contribution of an anti-war movement in the United States. But here we are back again in a very militaristic mood, bombing. I don't know how many countries we're involved in now. We've got about 1,000 military installations around the world. But we're actively involved in, as you know, bombing Syria and Afghanistan, Iran, not Iran yet, but they're talking about Iran, Iraq, Yemen, and we're financing other countries, such as Israel, to bomb Palestine, and we've already overthrown the governments in Libya, and
messing around with Venezuela's elections.
We're threatening Venezuela and interfering in their elections and the whole political process. So we have a major global human rights challenge for all of us, because this was a citizens movement, a grassroots citizens movement, to stop the war and stop militaristic thinking and teaching and to turn swords into plowshares. And so we have to get back to that, and in order to build our country with the education and healthcare and housing, transportation, all the infrastructure, everything that we need for our survival, having a clean environment, we need those resources here, even if you didn't care about the morality of what we're doing abroad. But we have to care about the morality now, because this is we're facing total destruction of the planet. Trump is playing with fire with North Korea, with nuclear weapons now. So to me, I see it as a very real, very urgent example of what King talked about then and what we're faced with right now.
And the fact that we need the kind of intellectual, that's something certainly we can borrow from the 60s, the idea of intellectuals who worked. Because we, in fact, we have to, and are willing to learn, which is one of the things we absolutely emphasize, that you have to come into the community and learn how to communicate to the community. Because, in fact, we're forced to put on masks. And what we're accustomed to, because we're navigating this public space, but particularly in academia, we have to put on these masks and pretend as if this pedagogy is meant for us, as if it's going to further us in order to jump through these hoops so that we can get the tools we need, which are these letters behind names, so that we can do or have certain liberties. And those doors are closing quickly. So then we must come into the community and learn the language of the people and understand what the hardships of the people are. Whether we've come from different places in our life, but we are not the same people we were then. Even when we were, what we've gone through, it changes us. What we experience changes us and language changes us, and it separates us to places where it's difficult. Talk to Shaniqua and them. Yes, she got three children, and she got one on the way, and the oldest can't read. And how do we impress that on her? And how do we help them understand that you can't go to the Save-A-Lot and buy all of that prepackaged sodium food that's going to kill your children before they reach a reasonable age? How are we going to develop methodologies by where we can reach into these systems that are holding our people captive, not only in the United States but all over the world? 1 in 8 people in the world who is incarcerated is an African American. That's a real number. What do we have to do? We have to put ourselves in that mode of sacrifice where we're living with our people again. Intellectuals and those people who are fortunate enough to have somehow made it to these farms that we have, that's passed out these, you know, these very hard-won designations. We've got to move back into our communities again. We've got to allow our babies
Hello. Speaking of numbers, we're at the number of 10, which means we need to take a station break. We need to take a station break. Hold your thought. Don't forget it. Hold your thought. We're going to take a station break right now. And so I like Brother Scotty Reed, who has done a tremendous job in terms of engineering the show and the founder, producer of Black Talk Radio. Scotty?
Black Talk Radio, your choice for digital black radio. New black media for the new millennium.
This is Onajima Weed on Race Treaty, and we are on your airways tonight with freedom fighters of different generations. One God, one name, one destiny, as Marcus Garvey used to say. And they are here with us speaking about, one, why are they, why did they attend the 102nd annual meeting and conference for the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, as we know, founded by the great historian who took us back, Carter G. Woodson. His first publication, his newsletter, was on Kemet. We're talking 1916. His first newsletter that he produced was on Kemet. So for him to have that knowledge as far back as then, 1916, shows the type of researcher that he was, and that we have continued to embrace that foundation and to move forward, claiming the past, the future, present, and the future, is such a delightful thing. And these guests tonight have answered two questions. One, why did they come to this gathering, and what they intend to achieve? And I'm so happy to say that they were able to very sufficiently speak to that. And now we're going to continue with Sister Sandra Simmons, who is the co-director of Hush House Black Community Museum and Leadership Training Institute for Human Rights and Community Sustainability. And sorry I had to interrupt her to say we had to take a station break, but hopefully she still held on to that thought. She can continue thinking, sharing with us what she was thinking about at that moment.
Thank you so much, my brother. I think that I'm just really just thinking about home, you know, and we decided to bring the museum to what has been called the hood, is to one of the poorest communities in Detroit, until this recent massive gentrification effort has turned our community, which was called Northwest Goldberg, a working community, post-industrial working community, into what they call upscale Midtown, because nothing that black people ever did existed until other folks came to tell them they had it. And so we are finding that many people are being moved out, and it is urgent. And I think the urgency of seeing that this move of this style of relocation, it's, you know, we've called it gentrification, but it's relocation, reallocation of our population around the country and around the world. They're going, you know, emptying places. Natural disasters come, and people and responses are not made, so populations can be moved. And so we need to look at these things of what's happening, and our response, at least how we have seen it, is that we have to build our own communities again, which can be self-sufficient, which can generate the energy it needs to run, and the people who choose to have the vision, whether they want to learn to be leaders and activate those skills within them. It's a skill to sweep well. You know, we receive people and believe that we all come here with gifts. We all have a purpose. And so the idea is for us to work our purpose together. And this business about these big eyes, that's ridiculous. We need each other. It's just like we're like a hand. Each finger is important. So the young brother, I adore you. I love you already because you are my son. Each of us, our sons, we have three sons. And generally when you have more than one son, you know something about the prison industrial complex. And we certainly do, sadly. So I'm just talking about what we know.
Wow.
Yes, brother.
So, Elder Muhammad Ahmed, we are now asking the elders to ask the question of Brother Keon that you might have for him, and in turn, he's going to get his turn. to ask you elders, you know, some questions about your work that you're doing or anything that may be on his mind. So, Elder Muhammad, anything that you'd like to ask Brother Keon?
I would like to ask Brother Keon what was his perception of our presence that he could or maybe fuse or process into his learning process to sharpen or maybe develop his direction. Does he feel, or, you know, from the little interaction that he has had with us, you know, has it helped at all?
Most definitely.
Okay. Then, I think that I would say mission accomplished, because you're the new part of the new leadership of our people, So I think, it's diffusing the past with the present, take it to the future, which is now. That's the only question I would have. So, I don't know how to articulate it. Brother Anaji, I need your help. Dr. Simmons or Sister Sandra,
Well, Keon, you're going to have to give us a little bit more of how you feel their presence at the conference as elders, the short conversation you might have had with them at the conference or on today's call, how has that provided any instruction or direction or insights that maybe you didn't have before?
Most definitely, I would love to expand upon that, and thank you all for the responses. Elder Simmons, I will be coming to visit you pretty soon there at the Hutch House. I can definitely say that for sure. You can count on it. I give you my word on that. You can count on that. Thank you so much. So to address the question, what is my perception of the presence, or what can I gain? What have I gained? And what does the fusion mean as the future is now, right? This urgency of now. I come back to those three things that are continuing to really bear upon my experience here, and what's going to happen after this experience, and what's already happening now, and to the point of the continuity question. Or the continuity theme that's been running all throughout the conference, and my conversations with everyone. If we think about these three spaces, right? These three spaces of the past, the present, and the future. even the way in which we speak about them and through our language, we already separate them into three spaces, right? As if they have their own sort of silos. And I like to think about them. I wish I could summarize it into maybe one word in such a way that really demonstrates the continuity of these three, that there's no one way to really look at it because we're all dealing with all three at the same time. And I think what I gain from this presence is that how to not lose sight of that. How to not lose sight of there's a future, there's a past, and there's a presence that we have to deal with them individually. We're all dealing with them at the same time. Even now, as we're dealing with the present, we're trying to blend what happened in the past and look forward toward the future, right? Even in the future, we're looking back toward the past and trying to figure out what does that mean for the present. So within these spaces, and what I've gained from everyone from thinking about this continuity question, right, of these three spaces, is how to use those as tools, right, and also use them as liberation tools, whatever space we may find ourselves, and keep that as a site of memory. So to that point of memory and that continuity of memory, how important it is to reclaim our stories, reclaim our histories. And also reframe them at the same time to figure out what does this mean for articulating for the future. So I mean that figuratively, but I also mean that literally, in terms of reclaiming. On the one hand, I think by being able to share this space with everyone, sharing this space with you all on the phone call, but also sharing it in a physical space, which I've had conversations with you, with some of you here at the conference, is giving me an opportunity to understand what can be done, right? And from your own experiences, how you tried to tackle this continuity question. And then there's this, I go back to that theme of the symbiotic knot. That one comes through fairly strong in thinking about this fusion of being here with everyone. Understanding that everyone, as Elder Simmons said, everyone has a role and everyone has a gift. And though the gulf between generations seem so deep, they seem so far, it's a myth. It's a myth. And that gulf that we have created, that some have created and we have now ascribed to, I think by having this conversation and having this space to be with you all has brought me closer, right? Brought me closer to myself, making sure that myth stays at bay. That we all play a role, just as I do, just as you do. And my point in being with you all is to understand what my role is in relation to your role, right? Then, now, and in the future, right? And then on this question of quantification, this theme is the other thing that has come through very strongly for me here at the conference. So a lot of my work, just to give you a little background, I started out in computer science and computer engineering, and then I went over to communication, and then I went over to history, and then ended up in Africana studies, and then later ended up in design. And so I went, you know, from my undergraduate to my master's to my doctorate, I mean, in my education, I've sort of been in these spaces that help me think about quantification of the body and what does that mean as a humanistic endeavor, rather than a scientific or a mathematic one, or at least not only just a scientific or a mathematic one or economical one. And by sharing this space with you all, the fusion that I've gained and the knowledge and the wisdom I gained from thinking about the quantification of the black body in our current moment, right, which has a lot to do with when we're considering digital technologies, the ways in which the form of people's bodies online through sound, through images, through text have been quantified economically for a gain for a capitalistic system, right? Now what we tweet, what we share, when we log in, when we say where we are on our locative media, every time we get that ding, it's being coded digitally. It's another economic quantification of our bodies, right? And how do we reclaim that, right? How do we reclaim that? How does that become a point of equity? not simply as the panel that was shared today about Brown, not simply equity, I mean, not simply equality, that now we have an opportunity to use these technologies in order to get better acquainted with one another or know what's happening, you know, what's happening on the ground. How do we have equity when we're talking about quantification of our bodies, right? How do we reclaim that? So by being with you all, what I gain from is having a deeper understanding of what quantification has meant in various spaces geographically, but also in different times, then, now, and perhaps in the future. So what I've learned here at the conference and from speaking to everyone here at the annual meeting is the ways in which this equity question and quantification and economics was always a crucial part when we're talking about a capitalistic society in the United States. And that quantification, we can't let go of that. As much as we talk about humanizing, we also have to talk about the humanization of these economic modes of labor, these digital modes of labor, these digital communicative modes of labor that now have become another kind of way of colonizing our bodies, even colonizing our language. And so what I've learned is, and to think about this regeneration, like, I am fired up by being with you all because it's giving me a broader sense that I have a limited lens. And when I'm with you all, my lens just it broadens a little bit more, right? Each time I'm with you all, it broadens a little bit more. And so that's what I gain from being with you all.
Wow. Wow. All right now. All right. As they say, hush your mouth, as the Hush House says. I don't want to talk about Shad. Hush your mouth. And you know, I will say that I've gained a better appreciation of the new colonization. So it's not just a question of colonizing our land, be it in Africa or be it here, as it was claimed by the Republic of New Africa. As Dr. Martin Luther King said, we live in domestic colonies. People sleep on that. Not Malcolm X. Dr. Martin Luther King said black people are living in domestic colonies. And now you're just bringing another lens of how that colonization has furthered itself in terms of our mind, which is an extension of our body, of course, in terms of this, the whole social media. I mean, it's unthinkable, but it's real that in the 60s and 70s, we would not have given so much of our personal information, you know, just to anything out there, whatever out there is. But now we have done that. So we have willfully, you know, participated in this colonization process. So to make things seemingly more convenient, it just made things more convenient for people to track us. And that colonization is now another territory that has to create liberated zones. Thank you so much for bringing that into focus for me. Now, Keon, you get a chance to ask your elders. They've asked you some questions.
I had to break in because we're going to have to go. But I want to suggest that we take this learning from the conference and take it back home and engage in these conversations with our people in the community. We don't have to wait till we get together at a national conference, because we can. It's very important to apply these issues to the local folks and see how they translate it and implement it. But we're going to have to leave. It was great talking with you, and we look forward to, you know, talking to you again soon.
Most definitely.
Well, I want to thank you so much for the time that you did spend. And, of course, Keanu is definitely going to have some questions for you since he didn't get his turn. So when he gets to Detroit, he's going to certainly pick up on the questions he would have asked. But I'm going to ask Keon to stay on if he can. And Elder Simmons, if any concluding remarks, and I would imagine that Sister Sandra would will be leaving as well. And I don't know if Brother Muhammad Akhman can stay on the line or if he has to leave as well.
Yes, yes. Just by age, you know, and we apologize, but for health reasons, you know, I have to leave as well, you know.
Yes, no apologies needed. You know, we certainly want to make sure you get all the proper rest and to maintain your well-being. So I do understand that. I want to thank all of the elders who gave us their time, their intelligence, their wisdom tonight. I will be in touch with you to continue this conversation. Of course, it's just another aspect of our movement. And I want to thank you so very much. But I'm going to ask Brother Keon, can he stay on?
He can stay on for a bit.
Okay. So, everyone, we're going
to...
Good night. Thank you so very much. Asante sana.
Okay.
Asante.
So those who are just joining us now, I want to thank you for being on the air with us. We're speaking to some of the participants at the 102nd annual meeting and conference for the Association for the Study of African American Life and History. 102 years. I mean, of course, that's like a century plus two. So just the spirit that runs through this organization, that you can sustain itself for that period of time is monumentous. I mean, I don't know of... I would have to now wonder who was in the same league with them, you know, in terms of sustainability, in terms of numbers, in terms of expansion. I mean, they have become the curators of our history, the holders of our history in many respects, in terms of the research, the papers, the writing, all of those things. So we have with us Keon Pettaway, who's a PhD professor of communications. And he is part of that continuation. And he just before the elders left us, he spoke about at least I heard at least five different disciplines or you know areas of study. He spoke about communication. He talked about engineering. He talked about communications. He talked about African American studies. Tell us again, what were these different disciplines that you studied in your education career?
So all together they would be in computer science, a bit of computer engineering, but mostly computer science, Africana studies, communication, English, composition studies, and design studies. So those are some of the major areas that I sort of come the sort of lineages that I come from, at least educationally. But all of those lineages also have come through strong in my many forms of education. In addition to my family lineage, there's a bit of historical significance even in my family regarding some of those areas. So.
Wow, that's incredible. And I don't know if you've had the opportunity to write about the confluence of all of those areas, because each one gives you a different perspective into understanding this objective reality in which we live, and certainly the subjective one as well, and have an insight into all those areas. You also have a chance to see how technology, right, has influenced those other areas. Each area influences the other area in different ways. And I'll be more than interested to hear at some point in time what those insights, what are those insights in terms of how all that comes together. One of the things I would have said to the guests, and I'll get back to them, is to letting them know that on December the 7th through the 10th, the United States Human Rights Network is going to have a national conference. And I was going to invite everyone to that conference. So it's an organizing conference, and the way they're going to approach it is to take the lead from the local human rights organization. And based upon what their needs are, it's bringing this national influence into a locality to see how we can be of assistance to them and what they're doing. And there's a set of principles that they're going to raise up and use that as the foundation for our engagement. So that's one point of reference that I'm hoping that us all on the call will be able to see each other face to face there. The second point of reference is that there is a movement. It's called the National Human Rights Cities Alliance. The National Human Rights Cities Alliance is a member-led and organized initiative of the United States Human Rights Network, supported by U.S. HRN Coordinating Center. It works to strengthen relationships among human rights city organizers, including grassroots local advocates for human rights cities, national and international human rights advocates, scholars, practitioners, and others working to advance human rights. This organization, of which I'm on the National Steering Committee, the organizers we met, we convened two national gatherings, Pittsburgh in 2015, Washington, D.C. 2016, and now we are organizing for our next major event, which will be in 2018 in Jackson, Mississippi. This is going to be major because we're going to continue the work of Chokwe Lumumba, now that's taken up by his son Antoine, who is the mayor of Jackson. And of course, those in the listening audience will remember that Chokwe was about building worker cooperatives. How can we own the means of production, and we can start to address some of the things that Elder Simmons had talked about earlier, and his wife, in terms of self-determination, in terms of self-development. So, Brother Keon, are you familiar with any of these movements at all, and do you see how you might be able to interface with any of them?
I know we talked a bit about the Human Rights Network. When you brought it to my attention at the conference yesterday, it seemed that I had heard a bit about it before through some other colleagues, but I had not known about it as much.
Okay, all right. So I'm hoping that your time would be able to attend the one in December as well as the one in the spring. We're going to, in a moment, take a break. I know that you said you can be on for a little while longer. So after the break, I was hoping that you can make any concluding remarks or any shout-outs, in fact, to your to some of your followers, families, and friends, because our programs are archived, and you will be able to share that with whomever you would like to share with. And we also ask our listening audience to tell those who did not listen tonight to be able to check in our reference the archive. So right now we're going to take another station break, and when we return, Brother Keon is going to give us concluding remarks. Brother Scotty?
Yeah, I'm sorry about that, Brother Najee. I was having some issues with my mixer.
podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
Good evening. This is Onajima Weed, host of Race Treaty. Tonight, we have entertained the topic, Reflections from the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, 102nd Annual Conference, Meeting and Conference, on the theme, Crisis in Black Education. Now, we are live in Cincinnati, Ohio. My guests have been Elder Muhammad Ahmed, Max Stanford, formerly known as Max Stanford, PhD, African American Studies and Political Science Professor in Philadelphia, as well as Elder Professor Emeritus Charles Simmons and his wife, Reverend Sandra Simmons, co-directors of Hush House, Black Community Museum and Leadership Training Institute for Human Rights and Community Sustainability in Detroit, and also Kenyon Pittaway, Professor of Communication at Eastern Michigan University. We had hoped to have my illustrious wife, Dr. Fatima Hafiz, CEO and founder of Transformative Education Associates, but the hard work that she had put in prior to the conference has rendered her in the state of rest that I would not disturb. We'll get her on. She's not going to get away that easily, though. We're going to get her on another time. So, Brother Keon, thank you so much for being on the call, having this intergenerational conversation, and I'd like to give you some time to make any observations, either from the conference or from the call, and anything that you'd want to leave our listening audience with prior to ending the program tonight.
Oh, Brother Nasir, thank you again for inviting me to be part of the intergenerational discussion. I think it's so important to continue these discussions in the very spaces where we find ourselves, on the program and the outlet that you have provided us with here tonight, out in our communities and our third spaces, and out in the institutions that we find ourselves. So I think it's important to continue having these discussions. So it's wonderful that you've created that space for us tonight. The thought that I would like to leave, sort of conclude, really comes from Stanley Nelson's film that was the last film that was shown here today. I think he may just have finished up his Q&A session, because he's here now talking about his the latest film, Tell Him We're Rising Up, about HBCUs and the history of the HBCUs in the United States. So, to that fashion, right? Tell them we are rising. I think that provides a space to talk about the crisis in Black education, both as a site of continuity in terms of this rising has happened before. It is happening. But what story will be told about this rising in the future, right? And I think we're still grappling with what kind of story do we tell about the rising now that the dust has settled a bit, right? I think to this sort of symbiotic question of regarding Black education, that it's not a neither or, but rather more of a symbiotic knot that's much more fluid. In terms of telling that we're rising, what are those consequences that are at stake? What are those that though that intention is part of that symbiotic knot, it's not. We still have to draw out those tensions even in the now as we're rising up. What are going to be the consequences later? And we already have a continuity sort of issue, right? Or rather a space to talk about that continuity from learning what happened before, right? As ways to consider what might happen and what might be the consequence. So beyond the intention, beyond the possibility, what are the consequences that we may have to reckon with as we move, as we continue to rise up now, right? I think that's important to ask. And then next, to talk about tell them we are rising is this quantification. And to that meaning of quantification, talking about equity, you know, when we're talking about the quantification of our bodies, the quantification of the spirit, of the body, of the mind, what sorts of issues are we going to have to deal with regarding those consequences when we're talking about when we're talking about economics? We're talking about labor. We're talking about class divisions. So I think this idea of where we've been, where we're going, and what's happening now, we can already see some continuities of people staking out their rights in various fashions and in various ways and in different spaces. And this sort of rising up is moving beyond our borders. And though we tried hard to move beyond our borders, to move toward a more transnational space that's much more fluid and perhaps is much more humanistic than thinking about, much more humanistic of thinking about the liberation of all people and particularly of black people. When we think about it that way, I think what we have at stake here is really understanding still, being in an economic and capitalistic society, what's the consequences of the ways in which we're rising up? So I would like to leave it there, and this is sort of my concluding thoughts as we experience these sort of rises and then these sort of fissures and then these rising up again. At this moment where we are now, where we can already see the rising, right? We can see it from afar. We can see it right in front of us. What are the consequences? What are we expecting? And what can we learn from continuity? What can we learn from that? This is not an either or. This is a symbiotic knot of what we're dealing with in terms of liberation and colonization. And what about equity? And what about the quantification, economically, class division, and of our bodies?
Thank you so much. And you can stay on to listen to what I'm saying, but if you have to go, I'd also understand it as well. But I want to share with the, thank you so much, Brother Keon, for being with us. Again, you can stay and listen to some remarks. Closing remarks I'm going to make, or if time is upon you of necessitates your leaving, I would understand that as well. I want to draw a link here. The theme of this conference is the crisis in black education. And with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 27, the Covenant for Minority Rights, it speaks to a people's human right to manage and to own their own institutions. With respect to the national minority, as it's called in the international language, people who occupy land space prior to the formation of a government, as we are a national minority in that sense here, certainly an oppressed nation here in the United States of America, we have certain group rights that have not been recognized. And what's consistent with international law is that when egregious human rights violations take place, people have access to two types of remedies. One is called special measures, and the other one is called special rights. Special measures is the attempt of a government that acknowledges its wrong to then put in place policies that would bring restitution, rehabilitation to a nation from those wrongs to alleviate the suffering. And in that respect, we can see that our people certainly are due special measures here. Alternatively, somebody would look at it conceptually as being affirmative action. The second remedy is called special rights. that's when a country will recognize that it's not a unilateral nation. In fact, it's a multinational nation. It's a multinational state. And then they would then put in place in the Constitution, in the social contract, some mechanism that recognizes those entities and then ensures that no other or further marginalization, oppression will happen to that group, because they will always have equal status as a political entity sharing power in the state apparatus. And certainly we need that as well. Right now, ICRAM, of which I'm the NGO representative, the International Human Rights Association for American Minorities, and is in fact very much attuned to this crisis in black education. So much so, for the last maybe 3 or 4 years, a focus has been on how do we preserve historically black universities and colleges. In the alternative report that's presented at the Universal Periodic Review, particularly as it relates to the United States, in May of 2015, they submitted to the UN Human Rights Council a report that looked at this crisis in education. How do we, in fact, maintain our historically black universities and colleges, although this country has not awarded those that status to us? And de facto, that's what it represents. If anything, that these institutions represent our institutions, even though we've never had fully control of them, but we can make the link to say that if that which is in place, how do we preserve that which we already have in place and things that have served us well? And in the beginning, it says longitudinal data covering the last 50 years suggest that African Americans still suffer from disproportionality, lower standing in social indicators measuring well-being. This is no less the case with indicators related to education. This report goes on to say that they are also disproportionately impacted by closing of schools and firing of teachers in their communities. Very similar to what was said at the conference in terms of Brown versus the Board of Education, and the breaking up and destruction of those independent black schools that we had in the so-called Jim Crow era. Article 13-1 and 13-2 of the International Covenant on Education, Social, and Cultural Rights, IESCR, and Article 5-DV of the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racism underscore the right of all to education. I assert Article 4.1 implicitly calls upon states to enact special measures, yes, as I mentioned, affirmative action, in order to address these issues, these violations, and explicitly specifies that until such time as equal standing of racial ethnic groups has been achieved, such measures are not to be regarded as a form of reverse discrimination. The education that Malcolm speaks of, the human rights education, is a process by which we can have the concepts, the ideas, and the values broad enough so that it includes our reality, not in terms of understanding it from a deficit point of view, but more importantly, being able to project it into the future in terms of a remedy of these centuries of oppressions that we have suffered. And we can see that grasping the understanding of special measures, and thereafter grasping the need for special rights, is indeed the rungs and the ladder that we have to climb, but we only can climb that ladder when we are clear about what these concepts are, and then be about the organizing in our communities, about human rights education and about organizing a way of asserting our self-determination on the question of education, on the question of housing, on the question of food, on the question of development. So we can see that there are a number of places at which these discussions are taking place, a number of places at which we are saying what the recognizing these needs, and now it's time for us to organize. I had mentioned prior to the departure of the guests tonight, upcoming there's going to be a conference in Atlanta, Atlanta, Georgia, that's going to be hosted by the National, the United States Human Rights Network, a people-centered movement. And they're going to hold December 7th to the 10th, they're going to hold their national conference. And we're inviting everyone to go to their website, www.ushrnetwork.org. That's www.ushrnetwork.org. Go to their website, and there you'll be able to find information about the conference in December, and you'd also be able to find their information on the National Human Rights Cities Alliance that was spawned from them, and we're working together to have our conference in Jackson, Mississippi, where our ancestor Chokwe Lumumba laid the ground of wrestling state power and making it an instrument for the people, because as Malcolm X said, that we must use anything that is going to help us, he said, by any means necessary. And all of it is for the purpose of organizing our people so we can put forth a demand for a plebiscite that is put forth an international observed voting process where we as a people finally declare our independence, declare the full enactment of our human rights, as Malcolm said, to bring into means, bring into actuality by any means necessary, and to declare what we want our relationship to be to this country, to the United States. This is our right. Youssef Clyde instructs us, jus auditor, that there's no law that's going to be observed without the people themselves declaring it. We have to declare it first before anyone else is going to observe it. In colloquial terms, you know, we used to say the squeaky wheel gets the oil, right? You know, closed mouth doesn't get fed. It's all saying that you must have your own voice first before anybody is going to recognize your voice or what's said in the voice, right? So we have work to do, and that is we have used the metaphor waking the sleeping giant. We've used that metaphor many, many times over and over again, and it's still waking. You know, sometimes we wake up, we go back to sleep. You know, we wake up, we go back to sleep. But the going back to sleep is not something that we are doing ourselves. We are being put to sleep. How is that so? We're being put to sleep by those who understand these contradictions are the ones who are targeted for economic assassination, moral assassination, and physical assassination. Anytime our leaders dare to speak truth, not so much to power, but to speak truth to the world, there was a way of silencing them. So our sleeping has come about through the silencing of those voices. And now we know we all have to stand together, and we all have a voice. I remember seeing a film, I forget what the name of the film was. It might have been a film on Mandela. And at the end, all the young people said, "I am Malcolm X, and I am Malcolm X, and I am Malcolm X, I am." So everybody was saying, "I am Malcolm X." And that is what all of us need to wake up. One thing that Elder Muhammad Ahmed said, he used the word consciousness, you know. We have to birth a new level of consciousness. And that new level is really the same level that's been all the while, right? Our right to declare ourselves as a people, you know, declare ourselves as an oppressed nation, and having all the rights afforded, you know, a nation. So what we're saying, this voice it's been there all along. You know, we might have different iterations of it and different nuances of it, but it's been the same voice that we are human beings, and we intend to enjoy all the fruits of this creation that the Creator has prepared for us, and we're not going to let anyone stop us from enjoying that. And we are reawakening ourselves, and that was evident by the voice of this brilliant young professor, Keon Pitaway, who gave us just a sample, just a bit, you know, of his intelligence and the things that he's working on. And being at this conference, at the 102nd Annual Meeting and Conference for Association for the Study of African American Life and Study, there are many young people I've seen, and many I didn't have a chance to speak to, but they're the genius. The genius that I've observed is quite inspiring. And I'm going to say to them, I'm hoping that one of these years they can make the conference a public media event where anywhere in the country and even in the world where people would want to hear this intelligence, they'll have access to it, not have to come out of their homes or leave their cities to partake in this sharing and to see how this struggle has continued. You know, one of the ways in which that you can weaken a people's will to struggle is to make them feel alone and isolated. And certainly our political prisoners are the ones who have suffered the extreme treatment of that in terms of solitary confinement. Many of our political prisoners being in solitary confinement for 30 and 40 years, unimaginable. But this is the reality that our freedom fighters have suffered on our behalf. They have stood up to wake us up, to wake up the sleeping giant, and their the response they had gotten from the oppressive state was their capture and was their isolation. Why? Because they didn't want them to be in general population, to share with the general population what their conditions were. And of course, we can think of George Jackson, but many others, we can think of Eddie Ellis, my teacher, who has departed this world a number of years now. And so we have to remember our political prisoners. We must right them, and we must still continue to struggle for their release, where they can be released to their families and be able to enjoy the remaining of their lives with their families, as any other human being would want to be with their families. So I've taken this time to make some links. So yes, we're talking about the crisis in Black education, the theme of the conference of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History. But we've also tied that theme to the work that ICRAM is doing, the International Human Rights Association for American Minorities, the work that they've done in terms of human rights centers in Geneva. And we will continue that work. I want to remind the listening audience that we are still in the decade for people of African descent, 2015 to 2024, and that should appear in all of our work and our activities to on those three themes of what? Of recognition, of justice, and also of development. Recognition of certainly is that we are humans and that we are being denied, you know, any type of status. And we want to fight for our status in the international community and fight for our status in terms of political status in terms of this country, be it a national minority or being that of the Republic of New Africa. We have to advance our political maturity to demand that right and demand that recognition. Moving on to justice, there's only one justice, and that is reparations that has three components. that is compensation, restitution, and rehabilitation. Indeed, all of that will therefore lead to, which is the ultimate portion of social development, which is the third theme of the decade. So this is Onaji Mweed, thanking everyone for listening in, asking you to spread the word that we are here. We are back on the air. We took a hiatus for the summer, but we're back in the fall, as they say, back in school, right? You know, so we're back on the airways, and we'll continue with our programming, and which means with our organizing. I would like to see how the brother and sister from Detroit can be a regular to give us an update in terms of the water crisis in Detroit and all the housing crisis and other crises that they are facing there, because only when we work together will we resolve this. We say, you know, Umoja, unity, strive for maintaining unity in the family, community, nation, and race. This is Onaji Mweed, the host of Race Treaty, thanking you for your attention, asking you to continue to organize, and signing off for tonight. Good night.